Sports Out of Time, Season 2, Episode 2, Randall, opening pitch. Have you ever felt truly in danger for your life?
Yes, I have. Did you want to know where and when, why?
Sure, if you feel like saying it, that's fine, yeah.
I you know, when I first moved to New York City, a long, long time ago, obviously I don't live there now anymore, but there were probably two times where I was on, you know, going back and forth from wherever, usually to home, right? And a neighborhood I wasn't familiar with. And, you know, there were some people that didn't look very, very reputable or moral. and there was, and it's, so that would be, there's, I think, two times, I can't remember exactly, like I said, where I was going or coming from, but yeah, where I was genuinely afraid for my life. How about you?
So I've been in three major car accidents, one of which I did feel like I was going to die because I flipped the car over and I was in a ditch.
Yes.
And I was like going down the ditch and you could like see the telephone pole ahead of me. I was like, well, this is the end. That's the end for me. It's been a good run. And then also, I was on a speedboat years and years ago with friends of mine.
Yeah.
And we got caught in a thunderstorm. I think I've told you the story off the air.
Yeah, I do remember that.
And there was a moment where me and my buddies were like, well, if we're going to go, this is quite a story. What happened to Sam? Oh, hit by a lightning bolt in a speedboat during a thunderstorm. Pretty good way to go.
Right, right.
Well, the reason we bring it up is today's episode, season two, episode two. Today, we are talking about the scary incident involving Monica Seles. You know, I think we probably talked about this. I don't remember if we said it on the episode or not. I feel like being stabbed is one of the scariest things you can imagine. Like somebody coming up real close to you. You got to get real intimate for it. I don't like it.
No, it is. That without a doubt. And it's, you know, I mean, obviously any form of violence is brutal, but it just seems like a real brutal way to be attacked.
Well, with a gunshot wound, there's like a detachment from it. Like it happens. Yeah. Like, oh my God. Like what happened? Right. You know what I mean? Like the knife. See him coming for you.
No mistake now.
I can't believe I stuck up for him. I feel like I've been stabbed in the heart.
We can't have him here in our social club no more.
Randall, we should talk to the listeners. You are podcasting from the road. You are in New York City, New York, as of right now. How are you enjoying your time returning back to New York City?
Yeah, no, we're having a great time just, you know, hanging out with some old friends who still live here and went and saw some Broadway shows, enjoying some delicious food and celebrated my wife's birthday. So it's been a great weekend.
Yeah, happy birthday to your wife slash my sister. Yes. Very exciting. I won't say how old she is. I think she's 27, I believe she turned.
27 is correct.
It's the correct number.
Yeah.
What's right. I won't make you spend any time on New York City if you don't want, but what's the best meal you've had so far since you've been down there?
We went to a restaurant last night called, was it Via Carrata or Mia Carrata?
Via.
Via Carrata last night.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Italian restaurant, West Village. But everything was so like just rustic and homemade, nothing fancy. But the food was incredible. The pasta was just homemade. It was light, delicious. They had these great meatballs with what was it, pine nuts and raisins.
Ooh.
And they were so good. And actually, Sam, the vegetables, we had a bunch of like salads and vegetables to start. They were all incredible. There was a kale salad, these roasted carrots, and there was another green salad. I mean, the food was great. So we had a great time. That was Kelly's birthday dinner.
There are so many things I miss about New York City. Food being number one of number one on the list. Just the ability to pop off at some amazing restaurant at any moment, at any second.
Yeah.
Like just there's so many.
Any part of the city, right?
Any part of the city.
You can be anywhere.
Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan. I guess maybe Staten Island. I would never know. I've never been to Staten Island, but
No, I took the ferry there once, but didn't get off.
So Randall, Monica Seles, this was a story that you'd pitched to me. And it's so funny. I remember, I think I probably said this at the beginning. When you said the story, I was like, oh yeah, Monica Seles. I remember Monica Seles. She was a tennis player. And I didn't remember the actual incident. So as I'm reading through it, I was just like, oh my God, I totally forgot about this. What brought this story back up? Why did you start thinking about Monica Seles?
This was actually a story that was kind of on my list from the very first idea to do the podcast.
Oh, really? Okay.
This is just because it's, as we've talked about, Monica Seles is right around the same age as me. So I remember her when I was younger watching tennis, when I could watch tennis. And then, after that incident, everything changed. And we obviously are going to go deep into that. But it's really a story of what could have been and, what the trajectory of her career was and what happened afterwards is it's a really interesting, compelling story.
Yeah. And it is fascinating. It does feel like her career changes on this day, April 30th, 1993, all the way back in Hamburg, Germany. But just to get you folks in the zone, why don't we take a little time travel back in our pop culture time machine to April 30th, 1993. If you went to the movies on April 30th, 1993 to see the number one movie in America, you would be settling in to watch the 1993 erotic drama film Indecent Proposal.
Oh.
Such as?
You can't buy people.
So what are you saying? You can't buy love? It's a bit of a cliche, don't you think?
It's absolutely true.
Well, let's test the cliche. Suppose I were to offer you $1 million for one night with your wife.
David, I think you want me to do it.
Why, do you want to do it?
No.
Yes.
Scandalous. I know. They don't make them like this anymore. Erotic drama films. Is that even a market anymore? Erotic drama? Do they stop making that in like the late 90s? I feel like it went to Cinemax.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. Have you seen this film?
No, I'm mostly familiar with the concept of Indecent Proposals because of this movie, but I've never actively seen it. Have you seen this?
Yeah. I have. It wasn't initially when it first came out. I just wasn't interested.
Sure.
But later I have seen it. And, I think like you're saying, once you get the concept, you're like, okay.
Yeah. You know what this movie reminds me of? This movie reminds me of the movie Wild Things. Remember the movie Wild Things? It came out in like 2000.
That's with Neve Campbell and
Matt Dillon, and I'm forgetting Denise Richards, maybe?
Denise Richards, yes. Yeah.
That movie was scandalous.
Yeah, it was.
And it was like, it was coming around to my generation. People were like, yo, you got to go see Wild Things. And then I saw it, and I was like, nah. I mean, like, I don't know. I don't know what the big deal is. I wonder if that was sort of the Indecent Proposal feeling in 93. People like, oh, you got to see this thriller. And then you see it, and you're like, okay.
I think so. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, it was a very popular film, though, as you just told us.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So directed by Arden Lyne, this is based on a novel from 1988 in which a couple's marriage is disrupted by a stranger's offer of $1 million for the wife to spend the night with him, starring Robert Redford, Demi Moore, and Woody Harrelson. Love Woody Harrelson.
Yeah. You know, just as a side note on the whole plot and what casting of Indecent Proposal.
Sure.
Now, I mean, it's Robert Redford who's offering the money. And it's like, really? Come on. It should have been. Why couldn't it have been someone who isn't like one of the biggest movie stars of all time and is super handsome? I mean, $1 million?
Okay. Well, is that not the point, though? Like Demi Moore looks at her plain Jane Woody Harrelson husband and goes, $1 million. Robert Redford. I think I
could do this.
If I'm Woody Harrelson, I look at my wife and I say, he's Robert Redford. I think you should do it.
Yeah, I think you would take way less to do this.
This movie received a pretty negative response from critics for the contrivances and improbabilities of the story, right?
Okay.
It also sparked controversy with feminists who argued that the movie's premise promoted prostitution and the treatment of women as property. Despite this, the Film is a box office success, grossed nearly $267 million on a $38 million budget, which makes it the sixth highest grossing film of 1993.
Do you think that this movie spawned the idea of a hall pass for married people?
I'm sure that this movie spurred a lot of interesting conversations on the way out of the theater.
Right? Exactly.
With husbands and wives, right? Like, I'm sure that there was a lot of questions. Well, no, I also think there's that episode of Friends where Ross and Rachel make the list, like the five people they can sleep with.
Right.
And it's okay. And it's like Isabella Rossellini's on the list or whatever it is.
For Ross. Yeah.
So we like to check in with our friend. We said this movie got bad reviews.
Yeah.
One of the few critics who actually liked this movie was our pal Roger Ebert. I wonder why. Ebert gave the film a thumbs up, while his colleague Gene Siskel gave it a thumbs down in his print review. Yeah, it's a little disagreement, which is always my favorite.
Sure.
Ebert, when they go at it a little bit.
Yeah.
Ebert admitted that there are large challenges to logic and the plot is manipulative, but said there is genuine romantic spirit at work here, concluding that it's a necessary suspension of disbelief is why we line up at the ticket window. We want to leave the real world for a couple of hours. He also described the film's decision to keep the actual night of adultery off screen as a wise choice.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember, but yeah, sure. That makes sense.
You're a little older than me. I mean, I remember Demi Moore from, like, I guess G.I. Jane and Striptease. Was Demi Moore like a huge deal though? Like, was she a huge star?
Yeah, 'cause this, this was after Ghost, I believe.
Yep, after Ghost.
Which really kind of propelled her to superstardom. Yeah, she was, I mean, she was one of the IT movie stars of this time.
Yeah.
And, you know, very, you know, yeah, beautiful, for sure. She was a box office draw.
Yeah.
No doubt. I mean, her and Robert Redford. Woody wasn't quite a box office draw, I don't think. But everybody knew who he was and they like him.
On your way out of Indecent Proposal, as long as you're not having very deep conversations with your spouse or significant other, you can turn on the radio to break the tension and listen to the number one song in America. And boy, will this break some tension. It's Informer by Canadian reggae musician Snow.
Yes. That's a Canadian reggae musician? I never knew that.
That's right, Canadian reggae. It's a very specific subset of reggae.
Very. It's actually my preferred subset of reggae. It's
my preferred subset. Released on August 1992 is the first single from his debut album, 12 Inches of Snow. Hilarious. This album is well known for the line, a licky boom boom down, and for Snow's fast toasting and often unintelligible lyrics.
Yes, right when the conversation is getting really awkward, luckily Informer can come on the radio and tell, this is our jam.
Yeah, a little licky boom boom down, you're ready to go. Yeah, it's all, you're back to normal. This was a chart topping hit, spending 7 consecutive weeks at number one on the US Billboard Hot 100. It was his biggest hit in the United Kingdom, where it reached number 2 in 2007. Informer, I love this, by the way. So here, this is exactly what you need to know about this song. In 2007, Informer was ranked number 84 on VH1's 100 Greatest Songs of the 90s.
Oh, God.
Also, the song was included in Pitchfork's 2010 list of the 7 worst U.S. number one singles of the 90s. So you're kind of either on one way or the other with this song. You either like it ironically or hate it ironically. But I don't know. I feel like I could not escape this song in my youth. It was all over the place.
Yeah, it was. And I was never, I'm sure you weren't a big fan of it either. But yeah.
I mean, 92, I was probably 6. So, and look, as a white dude who went to a high school where hip hop was very popular, I was always looking for some white rappers, and up until the Beastie Boys and Eminem, this was about what you could get, right?
And you probably didn't have a real strong opinion at that age on the music stylings of Snow.
No, I didn't, but I'll tell you what, I liked Vanilla Ice better because he had that appearance in the second Ninja Turtles movie, which I was really in on, right? There was a connection there, yeah. Finally, once you return home, you can settle in for a night alone reading on the couch after your conversation about Indecent Proposal, and you can settle into the number one book in America. It is The Client by John Grisham.
Okay. Yeah.
I feel like we're always talking about John Grisham and never Stephen King on here for some reason. But yeah, John Grisham shows up again. This feels like he's been back before on this show.
Well, didn't he own the 90s essentially?
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, pretty much. And I never read. I don't think I've read too many John Grisham books. I've seen almost all of the John Grisham movies.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen all of the books in bookstores when I would spend time in bookstores. Yeah. They were always very prominently featured.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, no, I mean, he's a pretty prolific writer as well. I mean, you know, but yeah, I would prefer Stephen King over John Grisham.
Oh yeah, for sure. I think that just depends what kind of stuff you're into. This is
exactly
more grizzled, I suppose, right? In 93, this is actually only his fourth novel.
Really?
The Client, set in Memphis, Tennessee, and also New Orleans, Louisiana, is the story of an 11-year-old boy named Mark Sway who takes his kid brother for a smoke behind their trailer park and witnesses the suicide of a lawyer driven crazy by a lethal secret. Before he dies, the man confides in Mark where the body of a recently murdered U.S. senator lies buried, and suddenly the game is afoot. Trailed by the police, the FBI, and an assortment of mafioso types, Mark retains the services of Reggie Love, a 50-ish female lawyer, as they try to solve this mystery. So there you go, The Client. Chicago Tribune wrote that the pace is plodding, and because the book never gathers any momentum, it seems painfully overlong. So they didn't seem to like it very much. however, the Kirkus Review wrote that the book opens with a neat hook into the reader's jaw and the tension never wavers. So again, much like Stephen King and Informer by Snow, people kind of up in the air about how they feel about this, the success of this, this property. As you mentioned, this was adapted into film in 1994 by Joel Schumacher, The Client, starring Susan Sarandon, Tommy Lee Jones, Brad Renfro, Mary Louise Parker, Anthony LaPaglia, and Anthony Edwards.
Sit down, son.
I need a lawyer.
What for?
To protect my rights.
You got nothing to hide. You don't need a lawyer.
Jerome Clifford wasn't really dead when you found him, was he, Mark?
We know. You lay in that car, Mark. You ever hear of obstruction of justice, Mark?
If I don't answer your questions, I could go to jail.
Maybe.
You're right. You do need a lawyer.
How many cases have you won?
More than I lost.
How much do you call?
Hmm.
How much
you got? Now, I'm not sure. I've seen this one.
I don't know that I've ever seen this one either. Roger Ebert gave this one 2.5 stars. He didn't say anything else. That was it. That's all I got.
Got it.
Yeah, The Client, 1994. I feel like I remember this movie, but I never saw it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I think that's exactly how I am.
And that, folks, is what you could have been doing on April 30th, 1993, when the ensuing incident that really shifts Monica Seles' career takes place in Hamburg, Germany. But before we get that, why don't we learn a little backstory about Monica Seles and get into our main topic here on Season 2, Episode 2. Randall, what do you have for us today? What's your big story for us this episode?
Well, it's a story about Monica Seles and one of the greatest scandals in tennis history.
Mm-hmm.
So let me set the stage here, Sam. Our story takes us back to April 30th, 1993, in Hamburg, Germany, where the number one ranked 19-year-old Monica Seles is facing Magdalena Maleva in the quarterfinals of the German Open. Now, the events of this match would end up being the greatest scandal in tennis history and change the trajectory of Monica Seles' career and life. Now, before we discuss the events of the incident, let's take a trip back to see how Monica Seles got to be the number one ranked tennis player at the age of 17.
One of her most recent successes was at the Virginia Slims tournament in Florida, where she beat the Canadian number one seed, Helen Calaisi. Monica grew up in the town of Novi Sad in Yugoslavia. She began playing tennis at the age of 7. In those early days, her only coach was her non-tennis playing father, Karol, who believes it is his daughter's dedication and willpower that has made her special.
Now, as you've often said to your students, you're going to forgive their pronunciation. I'm going to ask everyone to do the same with mine, okay? Just so we get that out of the way. Monica Seles was born December 2nd, 1973, to a Hungarian family in Novi Sad, which is former Yugoslavia. Monica learned the game of tennis from her father, a former triple jump specialist in his native Yugoslavia. Mr. Seles turned to sports science and to a successful stint as a political cartoonist after his own competitive days had ended.
I feel like I like this guy, political cartoonist, athlete. He hits a lot of check boxes for me. Yeah,
absolutely. First, he shepherded Monica's older brother, Zoltan, to a national junior title when he was 15, and then convinced that Zoltan's future did not lie in professional athletics, he turned his enthusiasm for coaching, along with his unusual theories about stroke production, to Monica. Convinced that a player capable of hitting double-handed off both sides would not only hit harder, but craft sharper angles than the rest of the competition, he instructed his daughter to play that way.
The one thing I noticed when I was watching a video for this, and I'm glad you brought this up right at the beginning, watching Monica Seles play, I kept thinking to myself, man, is she really just using a backhand the whole time? And it took me a while to go, oh no, she's just whipping that thing with two hands both ways. I'd never seen like it actually. Yeah. I've never seen it before. Yeah.
Yeah. It was somewhat unique, I believe.
Yeah.
Seemingly so. The tennis net used for family practices was a line strung between two parked cars in their hometown in Yugoslavia. And the tennis balls were illustrated by Mr. Seles with cartoon mice, using the cartoon Tom and Jerry as a ploy that not only gained the full attention of a six-year-old Monica, but inspired the makings of her legendary killer instinct when he told her to pretend she was a cat each time she hit the ball. So Tom and Jerry is international, apparently. You know, as a kid, you know, I would have never guessed.
as a fan of old school cartoons, I have noticed that when I go back and watch a Tom and Jerry cartoon, they are way more violent than even the Looney Tunes of the day. Like, the violence in a Tom and Jerry cartoon is next level. It's unreal.
It's crazy. But Monica's father never pushed either of his children, but rather he tried to make tennis fun for them.
It's smart. Yeah,
absolutely. So in 1987, the Seles family relocated to Bradenton, Florida, where Nick Bollettieri had begun offering his coaching services to Monica in 1986 after she had won the Junior Orange Bowl 12 and under tournament in Miami at the age of 11.
Since then, Monica has been snapped up by tennis coach Nick Bollettieri and has moved to the United States to attend his world-famous tennis academy in Florida, where she's become his star pupil.
That's excellent. We feel Monica is very unusual, I think, first of all, because of her European discipline, you know, the discipline background, because of her unique relationship with her mom and dad and with her brother. I'm almost frightened to say how good she might be someday.
Now, though some in the tennis establishment ridiculed the unorthodox strokes Mr. Seles had taught his daughter, Mr. Bollettieri left them intact, and in March 1991, she became the youngest number one ranked woman in history until the 16-year-old Martina Hingis usurped that honor in 1997.
Some of the biggest names in tennis history, by the way, we're going to keep mentioning throughout this episode, I've noticed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So go back to 1989 at the age of 14. She started to play professionally and won a tournament in Houston against Chris Everett, the former world number one.
With several major junior titles already to her credit, last year Monica went to the Nike International Exhibition match in Oregon, where she faced the Soviet world number 14, Natalia Zvereva. Monica, then aged 13, played like a veteran.
Only 2 years later, Selis was rocking it. The 16-year-old girl was climbing the ladder of success and became number 6 in the Women's Tennis Association.
I want to share with you a stat I learned while I was watching my research on this. If this is wrong, please somebody call me and tell me, because it seems outrageous to me. If the stat we're talking about is Grand Slams won before the age of 20, Monica Seles has the most all-time by a teenager at 8. Steffi Graf has 6. Margaret Court has 4. Chris Everett has 2. You know who has 0? Andre Agassi, Novak Djokovic, Roger Federer, Billie Jean King, Martina Navratilova, Serena and Venus Williams have 1 combined. So that's how far ahead she was at her age. Absolutely. Compared to the competition. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're going to get deeper into that.
Yeah.
So going back after being Chris Everett, only a month later, January of 1990, Monica won Roland Garros in Paris, where she defeated the famous Golden Slam winner, Steffi Graf. Now, this was a huge win because Graf is one of only 12 tennis players ever who managed to win both the 4 Grand Slam tournaments, the Australian Open, the French Open, Wimbledon, and US Open, plus an Olympic gold medal.
The video I watched referred to this as the Golden Slam.
Yes. You got to keep slamming the name, right?
We got to, how you elevate it more. What's better than grand? Golden, I suppose.
Exactly. Yeah, golden.
Yeah.
So at only 16 and a half, Selis was the name on the cover of every newspaper. The girl from a tiny country rewrote the history of tennis as she became the youngest winner of the competition and number 1 on the WTA list in March of 1991.
I know it may sound like an overestimation of myself, but I want to be a professional tennis player, one of the best players. If I do not make it, well, you know, I go to school. I'm also a good student. Whatever will be, will be. I shall become whatever I shall become. I cannot say yet.
In a couple of seasons, this teenager won 8 Grand Slams and 53 titles. With every win, money just kept pouring in, and Monica already earned $16 million. From January 1991 to February 1993, it was nothing but success. Monica reached 33 out of 34 finals. She had a 93% win rate. In other words, 195 wins and 12 defeats. So she was dominating.
Yeah, stunning. And
No,
I had an extra stat to throw in here. Not only that, in Grand Slams, her win-loss record was 55-1. So in those big Grand Slam matches, she had a 98%. Right. When it really counted, that clutch gene was there for sure. Right.
So as a comparison to who many consider the greatest female tennis player of all time, Serena Williams, she had 1 Grand Slam, I think you mentioned that, Sam, and 5 singles titles at the age of 19 with a 78% win rate. So, yeah, Selis was just far ahead at that age.
Context is important, kids.
Absolutely. But she wasn't just number one. The Guardian's journalist Tim Adams claims Selis was the greatest female tennis player to ever pick up a racket. Martina Navratilova declared that if Selis had been luckier, she'd have more Grand Slam titles than Margaret Court and Steffi Graf. Now, this is all pre-Serena.
Yeah. So
keep that in mind as well.
Yeah, I want to just make a quick note. A lot of this feels a little bit like when we used to talk about Tiger Woods, about like he was obviously going to break Jack Nicklaus's streak.
Right.
It felt like a foregone conclusion.
It did.
I'm sure that for many years it felt like a foregone conclusion that she was going to break all of the records that were set for her.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
The players that are able to produce their best tennis when it matters most are the ones that end up winning, and that's not easy.
The National Tennis Center, Flinders Park, Melbourne. Ladies singles final. Monica Seles leading 3-0.
Ladies and gentlemen, find a seat quickly, please. Seats quickly, please.
So the greatest scandal in tennis history happened on April 30th, 1993. Monica was playing a quarterfinal match in Hamburg, Germany against Bulgarian Magdalena Maleva. Now, during a drinks break in the second set, Seles leaned forward to have some water, and suddenly she felt a pain in her back. When she turned around, there was a man with a cap sneering at her. She had no idea what was going on. She didn't know the guy had just stabbed a 9-inch long knife in her back.
Günter Pascher, an obsessive fan of Steffi Graf, stabbed Seles with a knife during a changeover at the Citizen Cup in Hamburg.
I remember sitting on the bench. I was just like thinking to myself, I should change. I'm giving my opponent a little bit of too much what she liked. And then suddenly I just felt like such a hard pain, like a sharp pain in me. It's like, ooh.
And then he charged at her again. At the time, no one thought someone could attack a player on a tennis court. At the beginning of the 90s, terrorist attacks weren't common. There was no special security on the court because no one saw matches as risky. And if you could pay for the ticket, you were good enough for the tennis crowd. So was this attack a political threat? Well, there was a civil war raging in her southern European homeland, and Seles had already received threats because of politics, but that was not this. This was all because of love.
Yeah, I just want to point out, we talked about this last season. We talked about Drazen Petrovic, and again, another player who was connected to what happened. Again, from 1992 through 1992, Yugoslavia dissolves. This is the middle of the Croatian War of Independence from 1991 through 1995. And again, if you had connections to Yugoslavia, what was going on back there, it was a major political issue in the United States, in Europe. It was a big, major geopolitical issue at this time. And that was initially the thought. It was this connected somehow to what was happening in Croatia.
Yugoslav federal officials and Slovenian leaders were today face to face, but not eye to eye on the trigger issue, which threatens renewed fighting. The Slovenians refused to give up control over border crossings into Western Europe. The federal government offered up a compromise. Slovenia could run the borders on behalf of the Yugoslav government, but give up the money made from customs fees. No thanks, said the Slovenians today. That latest breakdown in talks has brought new warnings of doom.
But this weird 38-year-old local wanted to hurt her so his beloved Steffi Graf could become number one again.
Oh, my God.
Right? He did it for Steffi. Now, fortunately, he missed Monica's spine and vital organs with the first thrust. And fortunately, again, Monica had a bodyguard who jumped to stop the deranged German from his second attack. And Monica was actually lucky when he assaulted her. Thanks to the referee who said time to mark the end of the break, Monica bent over to sip some water. And thankfully she did, because otherwise her wounds could have been deeper with the risk of spinal cord, heart, or lung injury. And although the jab didn't cause a fatal wound, Seles was far from all right. But it took her some time to realize what was going on.
The 5-inch blade narrowly missed Seles's spinal cord. It was a sickening and unprovoked attack, recalled by her opponent that day.
I heard a noise like something like that. At the time, I didn't realize there was knife and blood. I just thought somebody hit her and she fell. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what had happened. I got a little bit scared for myself. Nobody knew what's going on.
When I was watching this video, one, you can't really see the video. It doesn't exist. There is no footage of the actual stabbing. There's photographs. There's the before and aftermath. Couple things I noticed. It is stunning how close you were able to get in 1993, right?
Absolutely.
You got to remember, folks, this is pre-9/11. This is pre a lot of the changes in security. You could go into airports in 1993 and watch the planes take off. It was a different time, a different world. We just treated
walk
things.
Walk someone to the gate.
You could walk somebody right to the gate. Yeah, that's the kind of world we're living in. And it's shocking now, but I guess what was to stop him, really? There was one big burly guy in a tux who, like, choked out the guy. That was the one person I saw who immediately grabbed him. That was about it for security.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, too. I mean, I I can't think of another time this has happened on a tennis court since then. Obviously, they probably put in some precautions. Yeah. Maybe it has. I don't watch all every tennis
match. I don't watch every tennis match. Yeah.
But, you know, we still see people running onto like baseball diamonds, major league fields. That still happens.
Oh, yeah.
Though it ends poorly for those people. It happens. But, no,
you know what I thought of, though? You'll remember this. And I hate to cut. Do you remember when those fans attacked the guys during the Kansas City Royals game? The Royals, yes. That was one of the things I was thinking of. I was like, that was something in our era a little later that I was like, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Two spectators jumped out of the stands attacking first base coach Tom Gamboa. The spectators, a father and son, started to throw punches at Gamboa. The umpire, Matt Hallowell, and White Sox second baseman Willie Harris appear stunned and frozen. The 54-year-old Gamboa had to defend himself, kicking the attackers. Here's the disturbing scene right there as he tries to defend himself.
The audience who'd been cheering against Celis because it's in Germany, remember?
Yeah.
Right. So that's why they're cheering against her. They were in shock. The girl was bent over on the court, her white tennis shirt covered with a red stain. They surely didn't pay for this and certainly weren't cheering for this. Right.
Yeah, of course.
So supported by her mother and brother, Monica was rushed to the hospital. And soon Steffi Graf dropped by to say hello. Oh, I'm so sorry, Mon. This has nothing to do with me. Sure, I understand. Sorry again. Got to go back to the tournament. Bye. See ya. So to both women, tennis was everything they had in life, and no attempt to murder could stop them. And again, this was not anything. Steffi Graf was not involved in this whatsoever. But yeah, it's one of those things you're like, yeah, this has nothing to do with me. And you're like, well, kind of does.
Yeah. Think about it. Well, you got to think, what if you're the other person on that court or on the other side of the court? You're like,
yeah,
did I win? I don't know how this works, right? Like, how does it just over? Yeah.
What do we do now?
In her office. Can you imagine being in your office and someone just opening the door, coming up behind you, sticking a knife in your shoulder? That's exactly what happened.
When I was in a tennis match when this happened, I was doing something that I love, and I never, ever expected something like this to happen. And you know, whenever I think about it, it's just very hard.
So the first few weeks after the attack, Monica couldn't move her hand, and she still was hoping to continue to play tennis because that's what she did, right? She was a champion. And at the time, Monica couldn't even imagine the impact the stab would have on her. And in less than a month, she recovered from the wound physically, but the attack left her shattered for years. Still, her attacker thought it was well-deserved. He had a very good reason to do it. But since this story is about Monica Seles, I don't want to get too far into the background of her attacker.
If you don't, though, there is something I do want to mention about her attacker. I know we don't have to get into his name, but I do think it's important to know, because this is going to play into what happens to Monica Seles going forward.
Yeah.
This trial and the subsequent trials for this man are so botched. It is such a mess. This man gets sentenced to 2 years probation and psychological treatment. He's never jailed at any point in time. Multiple attempts to appeal this don't go through. He essentially spent out the rest of his life just sort of living in Germany, mostly in a nursing home. And again, I wonder how much of that had to do with her and her mental state and her ability to, you know, recover, is the fact that this man essentially was unpunished for the remainder of his life.
Yeah, no, you're right. I don't want to mention his name. People can look it up if they're interested.
Yeah.
And he attacked because he was obsessed with Steph. He wanted her to be number one in the world, and he saw Monica as the obstacle. But yeah, he basically, like you said, he ended up living out his life. And I mean, I don't know how much of a life it is in a mental facility, but essentially, you know, he wasn't punished as you would think he should have been.
Yeah, for something that happened so publicly on such a big stage.
Exactly.
A 2-year suspended sentence.
To add the final insult to the injury, a German court found Monica's attacker guilty, but decided he no longer posed a threat and let him go free.
You turned around and you saw his face, didn't you?
Yes, yeah. Well, he watched my practices in the morning also, so I mean, I did not immediately know that was him, but there's no way I saw him, you know, the knife and everything.
So it took Celis 2 years to recover from the stab and get back to the court. And after her comeback, she won a Grand Slam again and played in the U.S. Open Finals against Steffi Graf, but this time Monica Seles lost. And she never wanted to play in Germany again, probably for the reasons we just talked about.
Yeah.
And never again did she feel indestructible. I mean, how could you at this point? Mm-hmm. Also, Seles never managed to regain her old success and fame. Although her wound healed, she still felt exposed. Her body wouldn't let her practice for hours like she used to. And Monica didn't feel like her old self anymore, so she started to eat out of frustration at night to fill the void while no one was watching. And even though she practiced 3 to 4 hours a day, she gained weight. And other diagnoses kept multiplying. Seles was now suffering from PTSD, anxiety, depression, and a sleep disorder. And at every press conference, journalists kept asking, when are you going to retire or lose weight? I mean, ridiculous, right?
You know, you gotta probably assume this is the late 90s. Now we're getting into the early 2000s. Yep. I don't even think it, you know, it seems silly, but that's almost 25 years ago, 25, 30 years ago, almost. Our views on mental health and how we treat and engage people with their mental health issues have changed drastically. So when you'll notice with a lot of this stuff, people seem to be very cold and harsh. And I keep thinking, no, that's kind of how people were in the 90s and the late 90s. Yeah. That was sort of how everything was treated, you know?
No, I think you're absolutely right. Now we look at it like, wow, that's not cool. But that's exactly how we handled it back then.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And with all of that, what was going on with Monica, things were changing in the tennis world. There were now beautiful Russian stars, Anna Kournikova, Maria Sharapova. They took the stage for the first time. And tennis players, female tennis players especially, not only had to be good, but they had to be good looking. So the landscape changed dramatically. And due to serious injuries, Seles retired in 2003. She returned to the court one more time in 2008, but then retired for good. Seles was too far from that bold teenage girl who didn't break when the going got tough.
Thankfully, the bad memories are fading. And Monica is once again getting on with living.
Is there any room for guys in your life?
Oh, yeah, but it's hard because you get to travel week in, week out. But, you know.
So is there someone on the scene? Is there someone on the scene?
Oh. Yeah.
It's a content.
I want to make a quick point here to you because I have a question for you. I was thinking about this when they brought it up. I'm going to share a number with you. From 1987 to 1990, Steffi Graf compiled a record of 305-12. She was one of the most dominant women from the 80s and 90s in all of tennis. And then you essentially have a 3-year blip where Monica Seles shows up and essentially becomes the best tennis player in the world for 3 years. And then this happens.
Yeah.
And then she never really wins again. And Steffi Graf goes back to winning a lot more titles. So I guess the question is, you know, it's really a question of what if, right? It seemed as though Monica Seles was poised to be the next generational star. It wasn't, it had already begun happening. It wasn't theoretical, you know.
It was in process, right?
Yeah. Drazen wasn't a full star when he passed away. Like he was on the way up, but she was a star, a full star already. Oh, yeah. You know, 3 years into being the best in the business when this happened. That's really what stuck with me is how much more could there have been? That's all I keep thinking at the end of this.
Yeah, absolutely. No, there's no doubt about it. She was the best in the world at the time. It was just a matter of how long could she stay the best.
Exactly.
Because I did that before when I was 14. Nobody said a word, but suddenly that was the biggest thing. And I always said, I don't want at the end of my career to be remembered for Monica, the grunting person. I hopefully people will know my results too. So.
Well, you know, there are now thousands of little girls all around the world who are grunting like their hero.
Well, it's really, that's the nicest part when you see some kid is hitting two hands of both sides. And it's so weird because...
So soon after the injury, Monica's father got sick. And since she lost the number one position, Seles had to find meaning outside of the tennis court. But, you know, it's hard to do that when the only thing you know, the only thing you've done your whole life is play tennis. Mm-hmm. Her father died of cancer in 1998, and Seles felt cut off from professional sports even more. He was her personal coach all her career, and they had a very close bond. So to heal, Monica started to write. The more she put words on paper, the more She understood her pain and her fears. And after all her losses, shocks, and grief, healing was slow and difficult, but in the end, it worked. And also, she slowed down and lived a peaceful life, far from the tennis court, constant travels, and press conferences. As her stress decreased, the emotional eating stopped as well. In 2019, Monica Seles published her New York Times bestseller, Getting a Grip on My Body, My Mind, Myself. It depicts her early success on Top of the World and how she lost it all in a minute. So if anybody wants to dig deeper into this, they can definitely look that up.
You know, I got to say, it really bothers me how obsessed we were as a culture by her body and her weight during this period. Like, again, maybe it's just because we feel so far. You just feel so off, like off, uncomfortable the way that it seemed people were so comfortable forcing some sort of answer and question about someone's personal issues in that way, you know?
It is bizarre when you look at it today. You're like, who would ask that?
And
it was affecting her game. So I mean,
for sure.
So you could say that it was somewhat related, but still not the question that should be asked in a press.
Yeah. It just seems brought up so many times when it comes to this late career for her. Yeah.
Despite my success, really, as a professional athlete and all the amazing opponents I faced, binge eating disorder was really my toughest opponent. Right. And this is why I decided to speak out openly about it and hopefully raise awareness, and decided to partner with Shire in doing public service announcements that you just showed. So hopefully we can help adults out there, both men and women, who might have binge eating disorders, to know that there is help out there for it. So
Monica ended up writing three books. The last book, Game On, talks about a young tennis player, Maya, whose life is strangely similar to Monica's. She came from a small town to a sports boarding school where only deep pockets and a lot of talent can make it. With a lot of competitiveness, wealth, and beauty around you, success is both a matter of effort and luck. So Monica Seles turned from a champion on the court to a writer. It's incredible how people are resilient once their whole life turns upside down. The stab changed everything that defined who Monica Seles was. And when she quit tennis, she realized that for the first time in her life, she could finally do whatever she wanted. There were no more tennis coaches to tell her what to do or journalists to point a finger at her for how she looked. So she stopped searching for answers outside herself and started to ask the fearful girl deep in her what she wanted. And Seles finally realized she was eating excessively because something was eating her from the inside, and she defeated that enemy on her own.
And I think it kind of just happened organically that I realized in my own experience there was such a shame and stigma attached to it. Oh my gosh, it's just about food, Monica. Just control what you're eating. And it isn't. Binge eating disorder is not about that. It's not about you not having enough self-control, because here I was a disciplined athlete. Right. And for me, really, the relief was when I decided finally I needed a change in my life, and I talked to my doctor. And they told me that binge eating disorder is a real medical disorder. It has not.
Some people don't last in their profession, but they leave an indelible mark. And we just talked about this a little bit, right? In just a few years of a career, Monica Seles became one of the most successful women players of all time. In what? You said a three-year blip, right?
Three-year blip, really. Yeah, really from 1991 to 1993, she is an unstoppable phenomenon, a force of nature that really knocks Steffi Graf off of the top of the tables for 3 years before she makes her comeback.
Right, right. Yeah. And who knows what would have happened if it weren't for that stab.
It's so funny. I was thinking about this today when I was getting ready to do this, and I was like, Monica Seles, I wonder what it was about Monica Seles that made Randall want to do this story. And I think I got like two pages in. I was like, oh, I see. And again, it's weird that I still knew Monica Seles, but this part of the story almost escaped me. This felt like something that I should have remembered and didn't. And I can't believe I didn't when we started talking about it and doing the research for it.
Yeah. So Monica Seles, we're about the same age, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So growing up watching her, I just remember, hey, this, I guess it's just one of those things when all of a sudden athletes are professional athletes are like the same age as you, even though I was 16 and I certainly, you know, she was a tennis player. I didn't even play tennis, but you're like, oh, this is like a contemporary of mine. right? It's the first time I realized that. So I don't know why I used to watch the matches she was in. She was famous for the grunt. I don't know if anybody remembers her grunting.
The grunt. Yep. Yep.
Yep. So yeah, it was just because, oh, I felt like she was a contemporary of mine. So I'm like, oh, this is, you know, I like her because she's like my age. And then of course, you know, the wheels fell off on her career when everything happened in 1993. And, yeah. It's always kind of stuck with me. And yeah, I thought something I always wanted to revisit.
Okay, just to make myself feel real bad while we were doing this, I looked up. This is just NBA players who are my age, who are 37 years old. This is just here's some of the guys who I could have been, right? How about Carmelo Anthony?
On the drive, out to Anthony Smith, the three-pointer, way off the mark. Chandler tips it out again. And the Knicks will reset down by two. Mike Whitson not calling timeout.
And I like that move.
In the hands of Anthony. Anthony for three. Puts it in! Knicks by one with 8.2 remaining.
How about Andre Iguodala, Dwayne Wade? Do you know I'm the same age as LeBron James? Did you know that?
Are you really?
I'm the same age as LeBron James, 37. Feels wrong. Am I wrong? LeBron feels older than that, no?
Most of those guys are retired.
That's right. That's right. I would like to be retired at 38. I just want to throw this out here because I did pull up a list here. This was from How They Play, which is a sports and tennis themed site. They listed the top 10 greatest women's players of all time. And they have Monica Seles coming in, even with the shortened career, even with only the 3 years of dominance, still coming in at number 6 all time on their lists. Again, 9 Grand Slam singles titles, 4 Australian, 3 French, 2 U.S. Open. She was inducted in the Tennis Hall of Fame in 2009. Just a wild amount of career prize money, just lots and lots of money she won. Who would you guess is number one on this list, by the way?
I'm sure they're putting Serena at number one, no?
Yeah, it's Serena's number one for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and probably justifiably so.
Well, it's funny because I looked up another list before this, and it was, again, same list, like top 10 of all time, and I didn't realize the list was from 2008, and I'm looking at the list, and I'm like, man, Serena's really low on this list. She's like, number 9? That's weird. And I was like, oh, that's right. So it only took like 15 years for her to go from number 8 to number 1 unequivocally.
Serena Williams and her scariest. Maria Sharapova never really had a chance tonight. From the start.
By the way, they did have Steffi Graf in as number 2 all time. They had number 3 was Martina Navratilova, number 4 Margaret Court, which could be an interesting story one of these days. I might keep that in the back of my mind. And number 5, Chris Evert. Randall, I have to ask you, because we're sports fans from a certain era. When I say the name Chris Evert, besides tennis, what else does it make you think of?
I'm not going to remember what it is.
Okay.
I'm not going to remember what it is, Sam.
This is a real early 2000s sports moment. I watch this highlight all the time. You can find us on YouTube. Do you remember Jim Rome?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Remember Jim Everett? Quarterback Jim Everett?
Oh, yeah. He was the Rams quarterback, right?
He was the Rams quarterback. Yeah. So for folks who've never heard about this, Jim Everett was fine, and he was a fine player, and he went on Jim Rome's talk show. And Jim Rome,
I remember this,
just kept calling him Chris. Like, he was talking down
That's
to him.
Right.
He's like, what's up, Chris? And Jim Everett's like, hey, man, if you call me Chris one more time, I'm going to like punch you in the face. He's like, whatever, Chris. And then Jim Everett, like, knocked him out of his chair.
He did. I, you know what? I was just watching that. Oh, not that long ago. Yeah. I rewatched that. because it is a, it's hilarious moment.
Call me Chris Everett to my face one more time.
I already did it twice.
You call one more time. We better take a station break.
Well, it's a 5-minute segment, our 5-segment show. We got a long way to go.
Well, we do.
We got a long way to go.
We do.
I'll get a couple segments out of
you
before.
Well, it's good to be here with you, though.
Well, it's good to see you, too.
Because you've been talking like this behind my back for a long
time. But now I said it right here.
Right, exactly.
Well, we got no problems
then. Well, I think that you probably won't say it again.
I bet I do.
Okay.
Chris?
I feel bad that that's the thing I remember for Chris Everett, even though, again, she's another, like, the fifth greatest women's tennis player of all time. But I'm
it really had nothing to do with her.
Nothing to do with her at all. but yeah. So, Randall, this was great. It does make me wonder, you know, I've looked over the years. One of my great, like, passions, you know, in life has been soccer and, like, soccer fandom and learn, kind of catching up on, like, the history of soccer. And later this season, we'll get into one of the great soccer stories that'll be fun sort of digging into as I start doing research for it. But one of the things I always was fascinated with, especially in the 80s and 90s, was soccer hooliganism, especially in England. And you saw this a lot in Manchester United and Chelsea with the West Ham Ultras and the Chelsea Ultras. And I've probably talked about it before, folks. You should look for a book called Among the Thugs by Bill Buford. It's a phenomenal book about a journalist who went in with the Ultras for one of these teams and, like, saw what it was like from the inside. And again, there felt like an era when, I don't know, just the proximity that you could have to athletes and the way that these sports were sort of the security for them, it all felt very dangerous in a way that, like, you'd never, you go to a Yankee game today and you can barely walk in without getting, you get metal detectors, you get, it takes 2 minutes to get in there, they got to do the whole bit. Right. It just seems like it seemed like such an oversight for back then to be like, oh, maybe we should put up something to stop the fans from being able to actively grab and touch the players or get on the field with no resistance at all. Like, apparently that was just never an idea.
And Chelsea fans who'd just seen their club relegated to the second division invaded the pitch by bursting through a safety gate. They confronted the Middlesbrough fans and began throwing bottles and stones at them. Police then moved to contain the violence, first on foot and then with the help of mounted men who arrived along with police reinforcements.
In some ways, it shouldn't have to be an idea, right? Because, I mean, back in the day, they're like, this, no one's going to do that because that's not what we did. But things change. And I don't think, I don't necessarily think people change. It's just more people had access, right? So there's always going to be those people out there. But now they decided to use the access. Well, you just saw this season with the White Sox, somebody snuck in a gun in their fat folds. Did you hear that story?
No, I did not hear that. Is that a real thing? No.
Yeah, a woman snuck in a gun in her fat folds and ended up shooting herself and her friend.
Was it like an AK-47? I assume it was a handgun, I would hope. Not like
I believe it was a handgun. But yeah, there was all this speculation. Was it a shot from outside the stadium? Did somebody just shoot it in the air and it came down? Because there was, like, no altercation. And then it turns out that the woman stuck the gun in her fat folds and shot herself and her friend. So,
well,
there you go.
You know, not for nothing, though, there probably are places that have more access. Like, again, maybe in Oakland, where that stadium is essentially falling apart and there's no baseball being played and people are, like, having sex in the stands, which is also a thing that happened this year.
That did, yeah.
But I'll actually give you a good example of this before we close up here. Years ago when I was living in New York, my buddy Dano, who I used to do my original podcast with years and years ago, he is a big New York Red Bulls fan for Major League Soccer, which is in Harrison, New Jersey. Yeah, Harrison, New Jersey. They have a nice stadium. It's actually a really beautiful stadium out in Harrison. If you ever get a chance to go out there, folks, it's great. And we got tickets to see the Red Bulls play. I don't even remember who it was. Maybe like the Vancouver Whitecaps, something like that, right? And there was probably, I don't know, there were probably 8,000 people in the whole stadium, and they were all, like, in one section. And we bought seats, like, in the front row at the 50-yard line, essentially, which is not even a great place to be. In soccer, you want to be on one of the ends or the other. You kind of don't want – it's not like American football. You sort of want to be in the center. And we were so close that we were actively talking to one of the players. Like, he was right next to us, and we were chatting him up. And even that, I was like, this is kind of weird that we have this much access to this guy. You know, it was just, he was right there. So I guess in, like, smaller scale sports, like not like Major League Baseball or football, but like in an MLS game, you could pretty much walk right up to an athlete and say hello. Monica Seles. Monica Seles. It's been a long time. You couldn't do like a Monica Seles Halloween costume right now. Is that in bad taste if you did like a... it's probably a bad taste.
What would be... Yeah, I don't know. Just like a tennis outfit with...
Yeah, like no, I don't... Shoulder, yeah, I don't
yeah I'm not yeah. sure that... Yeah. I mean, it's not too soon, but it's still not in good taste.
No, I think you're right. I think that's right. have you ever done we'll probably talk about it in a few weeks. Have you ever done a sports Halloween costume?
Oh, absolutely. Just because I know in college I went as a baseball player because I had a jersey top and a hat.
And a hat, yep.
That was the easiest thing for me to do. Yeah. I don't know that as a kid I did though. I mean, it was mostly Star Wars, a lot of Star Wars, and then, whatever cheap costume we can buy.
I had a lot of good ones. I was Dracula. But as an adult, I have done soccer player because, again, just I happen to own all of the stuff. And if I have to put it together at the last minute, I even have a Messi jersey and the shorts. So I could say I'm Lionel Messi. I have the beard. It's fine. It's like, oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Messi. Yeah. So before we close up today, I don't want to keep you too long while you're enjoying the last days of vacation here. I had three things I wanted to bring up to you real quick. So let's start with this. Between now and the time we speak again for episode 3, the NBA will beginning tomorrow from the time people hear this. What are your thoughts on your beloved Chicago Bulls heading into the 2023-2024 season?
Don't anticipate it being much of a season for the Chicago Bulls. They really didn't do anything to improve the roster. It's like they're not picking a lane. They either need to tear it all down, which I really think is the only option. They need to start over. And I'm anticipating a miserable season.
A miserable season. Now,
your New York Knickerbockers, however, that might be a different story. What do you think?
Well, first time this year we're talking about the Knicks, which means I get to use my favorite Knicks drop.
Fresh out the garden, baby! We're taking it all the way!
We had De Blasio! We had Cuomo! It was rough shit! But we have the Knicks!
Run New York! Knicks! Run New York City!
Bing bong!
Tell me a little something, KD! Don't you regret not coming to the Knicks! Don't you regret not coming to the Knicks!
Let's go, Knicks! Let's go, Knicks!
But no, honestly, I think that it's a little weird. They're kind of much like the Bulls in a different way. They're in like two places. They're certainly holding on to assets under the guise that they can land some begrudging star who wants to leave, maybe an Embiid or a Donovan Mitchell or a Giannis theoretically, but I don't think that's going to happen now. They're still a team who's probably like a 4-6 seed in the East, probably like a right above the play-in. I don't think they're good enough to make it out of the second round, but they're probably good enough to win a first round game against a 4 or 5 seed if they were one or the other. I just don't think they can beat the best teams in the East with their roster the way they are right now.
Yeah, I think I would agree. Do you think if they were able to get somebody like a Mitchell, it would change them enough? I mean, I guess you don't know what they'd have to give up.
Well, that's the problem you get when you like a team, but you want to get better. Because every time I hear a trade package, it's like, oh, it's Quickly and RJ, and I'm like, oh, I like all those guys. But you gotta give up somebody, right? Like,
you do.
I don't know. I think that RJ's hit his peak. I think this is the player RJ is, and he's not good enough to be the number two on a team that wins a title because he shoots up too many bricks. And I hate to say it because I like him, but he's limited, and unless they upgrade that position, I think that's the next key. You know, I like Hart. I like Brunson. I like Randall even. And I like Mitchell Robinson. I just think that RJ is, I never know what you're getting from night to night. And that's a problem.
Okay. Yeah.
Also, as we speak, before we move on here from live sports, by the end of this week, by the time we talk again, the World Series will probably have already started. Currently, the Diamondbacks won tonight 5-1, which means they're going to Game 7 with the Phillies probably tomorrow.
Nice.
And the Rangers are up 4-2 as I record this in Game 7 against the Astros. They're in the top of the fourth. Randall, who would you most like to see win this World Series of these four remaining teams? Rangers, Astros, Diamondbacks, or Phillies?
Ah, that is an interesting. I'll tell you what. Anybody but the Astros, and I'm okay. I know, you know, everybody hates the Astros now.
Sure.
It's an easy take, but it's true. But if I had to pick one, I would probably go Texas. They've never won. So why not?
I'd be interested in the Diamondbacks just because it seems like such a wild story, but I don't have any love. I don't have any love for the Diamondbacks. It's just interesting that they're like the worst of these four teams and they're still here somehow.
And I do like, I think the Phillies are fun to watch, but you know, again, I don't have any love for any of these teams. So why not Texas?
I have a hard time rooting for Philadelphia teams in general.
I know you do.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough.
Yeah.
Finally, I have a dilemma. This is not a sports related dilemma. This is a movie related dilemma. And I want to ask your opinion. So for folks who don't know, the new Martin Scorsese movie came out earlier this weekend. Killers of the Flower Moon. If you haven't looked at the trailer yet for it, DiCaprio, Robert De Niro, all the classic Martin Scorsese characters. They're back doing Martin Scorsese stuff.
Neil Kanska. Children of the Middle Waters. Move, said the great white father. There are many, so many hungry wolves. Can you find the wolves in this picture?
I've been reading this book, Killers of the Flower Moon.
You have? Okay.
I have, yeah. By David Gran for a while now. And the movie just came out this weekend. So I got about 120 pages left. My question for you is this. If I read the rest of the book before I see the movie, I will essentially spoil the movie for myself. Should I stop reading the book about halfway through, go to see the movie, keep myself surprised, and then come back and finish the book? Or should I power through, finish the book, and then go watch the movie?
That's actually a really interesting question.
I've been thinking a lot about this.
Yeah, no, I could see where... I could see going both ways, right? So you're about 120 pages away from the end. So you understand all the characters, you know everything that's happening.
Yeah. Well, now all the action's heating up to in this last 120 pages. So now you're getting to like the good, like conclusionary stuff. So I'm like, now I'm going to start learning some stuff.
I think what you should do, I think you should go to the movie. And let me explain why. You should stop reading, go to the movie, and then... You know, because, you know, I don't know how, you never know how much they stick to the book, right? What kind of liberties they take. So you'll know kind of where you're at in the book and how much liberties they've taken so far, right? And then, of course, you'll see this ending and you'll be like, okay, that seems to track what I think is going to happen. And then you can go back and see how accurate it is to the, or how closely it was to the book.
It's a great book for folks who have never read it. I'm really enjoying it. It's quite good. I guess really just depends on when I get a chance to go see the movie as well, too, right? Because when's the next time going to see a movie isn't quite as easy as it used to be. All right, Randall, I've taken enough of your time on your wife's birthday weekend. I'm going to let you go and enjoy your final evening here in New York. Thanks for taking the time out, and we will be back next week with something that, God, I've been waiting to talk about for so long, but we'll save it for next weekend. Randall, thanks again for bringing this story up to us.
Yeah, thank you.